Welcome to NucleCast, the official podcast of the Amwha Deterrence Center. Our host is Dr. Adam Wildberg, co-founder and vice president for research at the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. The Amwha Deterrence Center is a 501c3 organization ensuring a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent and its ongoing modernization. Thank you for listening and welcome to the show. The views of the host and the guests are their own.
Welcome back to another exciting episode of NucleCast. Of course, as always, I am still Adam Wilder. And today, as with every single episode, we have a great guest. Of course, I'm talking about Bill Hennigan, who is the national security correspondent for the New York Times opinion section. And he has been writing a really interesting set of articles that I think Bill was telling me he's going to spend 2024, 2023, 2024, writing this entire series of articles on nuclear issues. And of course, as the listeners may have, I've read some of the ones he's written thus far and thought it would be a great opportunity to bring Bill on to talk about the articles he's writing, sort of why is the New York Times so interested in it now, and how does he see the landscape. And for you NucleCast listeners, you know, Bill's going to come from this from a different perspective than most of you are DOE folks, you know, DOD folks. You've spent your careers in the nuclear enterprise. And so, you know, for Bill as a national security correspondent who looks broadly across, you know, many issues, I mean, he's written on lots of other issues. It's a good opportunity to hear a different perspective and to see how others might be thinking about the issues that we sometimes take for granted because we do it every single day. With that, Bill, thanks for joining us.
My pleasure, Adam. Great to be here.
So you're writing a series of articles, and I will tell you, I've read most of them, and the graphics are great. I wish I had such good graphics, but the New York Times, they can afford to do that. So it's been an interesting set of articles. Tell us about the motivation for those articles. Like, why did the New York Times, because you were at Time Magazine, you came in to write these. What was the motivation for them? What do you hope to accomplish with them? And what are you, from your perspective as a journalist who covers national security, what's sort of your ahas, your things you didn't know before, but now you know that you're delving into it?
Yeah. Well, as you know, I've written about national security issues for about 15 years. And I've always been interested in the nuclear portfolio. It's always been a kind of a niche of mine that I've covered over the years. And then the New York Times, the New York Times wanted to cover this issue in depth this year. There was a convergence, as we all know, there's been a convergence of things that are happening. I mean, the various modernization efforts across the globe, the dissolution of various arms control treaties, and the war in Ukraine, of course, where we've heard, explicit and implicit threats of nuclear use almost from day one. And so New York Times wanted tapped me to helm this thing, and as you say, I mean, it's not just my words, right? It's kind of it takes all the parts of the section, which includes these very immersive graphics, great photography, video, as well as audio and podcasting.
And so is it just sort of, at least for you and the Times, I know you've got a long-term interest, because I think you and I first met when you came out to Kirtland Air Force Base and I was part of that hosting delegation. But for the Times, is it just, hey, the world is changing? Is it, was it China's nuclear breakout? Was it, Ukraine? I mean, you kind of gave me a sense of what these drivers were. Were there other drivers? And then what are you and the Times hoping to accomplish with this year-long focus?
Yeah, I mean, you nailed it, right? I mean, the fact that there is this three-body problem and the United States and the world has never faced before between, you know, with three near peer nuclear powers. Really the main goal of the New York Times is just to get these issues out in front of people. This is something that's been forgotten largely by the mainstream, you know, by entire generation, right? We've gone about 25 years without really seriously looking at this issue. I mean, I understand that the work is always being done, but, you know, as we've talked about before, you know, 9/11 threat of terrorism replaced the concerns over nuclear weapons, has been put on the back burner. And because of all these issues that we've talked about, the rise of China, the war in Ukraine, the various modernization efforts that are taking place, all of this is just a good excuse to start talking about this and to put it out in front of people and to make them understand, you know, what actually is going on. Now, as you pointed out at the top of the show, you know, I am not, my articles are not dealing with the minutiae, you know, where I'm not talking to the initiated here. I'm trying to put these issues in front of people, everyday people who, you know, haven't thought about are not steeped in the arcane jargon and all of this.
Yeah.
And really trying to make it real for them, to understand the various things that are going on and why we're in this new nuclear age.
And so as you've been spending a lot more time on this issue, what have you really sort of discovered that you didn't know before? Have you had aha moments? Have you had oh shit moments? I mean, what's been sort of the highlight of the effort?
Yeah. I mean, I think the most jarring thing that I've discovered was the period in fall of 2022 in Ukraine conflict and how close the U.S. government believes we got to actual nuclear use in Ukraine. You know, as you said, I've been covering this since the tail end of 23, and I talked to, you know, over 100 people about the era that we're in here. I went to Japan, Hiroshima, Nagasaki, and talked to folks on the ground there. But I also did a fair amount of reporting here in D.C. And, we remember that period, right, where, you know, President Biden was talking about, the Cuban Missile Crisis and these sorts of, there was this messaging that was going on by the administration. And, to me, as a reporter, my antenna went up because I knew that there must be something here. There must be something more here than just this sort of, they say they're going to use a nuke, just kind of passing it off. Anyway, I was able to talk to a number of people within the White House and at State Department, at the DOE, about this period in which, as you remember, you know, Ukraine was clawing back territory, and there was this, the counteroffensive was really being successful, and the Russia was on the back foot, and there were fears that they were going to lose Kherson and Kharkiv, and here the United States believed, and U.S. intelligence agencies believed that Putin was more willing to use a nuclear weapon, a tactical nuclear weapon. I was told it was in the single kiloton range, or below, as a message, you know. Well, first of all, I mean, it wasn't just a message. There were thousands of Russian service members at stake, of course. But if Ukraine was to break through that line and then turn toward Crimea, I was told that it was it came down to a coin flip. U.S. intelligence believed that it was about a 50-50 chance about whether or not Putin would go nuclear there. And, you know, as somebody who reads about the history and, you know, Cold War history, and, you know, I almost fall on my chair when I heard that. I mean, it was just, we've come close, of course, over various points of time, but, a 50-50 chance, that was stunning to me. So that was really, I would have to say that was the most alarming bit that I've come to find throughout my reporting on this.
And so what has been the response that you've gotten from both the professional community and then sort of Americans at large?
Well, I think from the professional community, I've gotten good reviews. I do acknowledge the fact that, you know, the sort of topics that I choose and the sort of subjects, you know, they recognize that I am talking about this at a general level rather than, you know, the sort of detail oriented work that, you know, people in this field are immersed in. The American public has also responded well to me. Mostly people are talking about what they remember about the Cold War. You know,
yeah.
There's every other day I get a message from a reader who will talk about, you know, the duck and cover drills and, you know, or watching The Day After for the first time or these sorts of things. And people are remembering those Cold War days and fearing, you know, about what we're dealing with now. You know, but the thing is about nuclear weapons, as you know, it's kind of a filtered audience. By that I mean, you know, not everybody wants to read about nuclear weapons. People got a lot going on in their lives. You know, they got a lot of problems going on. They're like, oh, well, you know, do I got to worry about nuclear Armageddon as well on top of this? So I do recognize that there are going to be people that are just going to be turned off by this. But I have been very impressed by the amount of interest in the series since it launched in March.
Now, talk to us a little bit, because most of our audience is going to be folks who, you know, they're within the nuclear enterprise. They've spent their careers doing it. And they tend to be supportive of the enterprise and modernization and all of that. And for us, as we look at sort of much of the coverage of all things nuclear, we generally have a tendency to see articles tend to be much more frequently. They're critical of the nuclear enterprise. They have a tendency to, you know, when they're quoting, you know, knowledgeable people, they tend to quote people in the disarmament community. So could you sort of help we, the nuclear enterprise folks, how can we do a better job of, you know, working with journalists, communicating, you know, why we support nuclear modernization? And, you know, because, you know, for me, I've written two or three articles critical of Annie Jacobson's book because there's, you know, a lot in it that's just, you know, it's that's not accurate. That's not accurate. And so, but, you know, we tend not to, our voices often sort of overcome. What can we do better? You know, you're a journalist, you're writing on the topic. What are your insights for us?
Well, first of all, you know, I think that this issue is intensely undercovered, and that's why I've always covered it, because I feel the stakes are so high, and, you know, there just are not a lot of journalists that are steeped in this stuff any longer as there was during the Cold War. And, you know, so they do, many journalists need a lot of hand holding on this. You know, I've been lucky enough to work with people at the NNSA and, you know, in the military, certainly, to actually see the work being done at these places and to be alongside folks as they do it. You know, that stuff builds up over time. You know, that takes an investment of time and years of work to kind of build up the trust and knowledge of the way things work. You know, how when you're talking about, you know, quoting the disarmament community, well, I do feel as though that they, that the disarmament community for the long, you know, for the longest time, they've been the loudest in the room. Right.
Sure.
And they, are, have a major presence in Washington, D.C. And so, you know, when they're waving their hands, it's easier to talk to those folks. Cause you know, especially for somebody who's not, who doesn't cover these issues very, very much, you're going to go, well, who can I, you know, who can I call? Who can I call? And so, you know, that sort of thing is, I think that explains that a bit. I also feel like, you know, when it comes to the deterrence, part, the deterrence element, there's just not as many groups as there used to be, you know, in the 70s and 80s where, you know, you could go to those folks where they're cranking out work and blast emailing it out to people, to journalists about, hey, look, this is the work that we did and this is what the way it looks to us. I feel like, you know, we're starting to see that change a little bit because of the modernization effort and the amount of money that's going in this, the rise of China, of course, and their modernization and expansion. So I do feel as though that's going to shift a bit. And I've already seen that, you know, in your podcast, I think is an example of that, right? Because I look for this stuff. I look for, you know, I look for nuclear podcasts and, you know, I think you're the only one that's doing anything like this of bringing people from the enterprise. And I, you know, it hasn't been done before really, as far as I can remember. So, you know, that's how these things are, you know, are evolving in a way. But, you know, as we talked about before, nuclear weapons has just not been top of mind for many journalists, and it's kind of been the land, you know, we've put it into a realm of abstraction almost, right? And but now we're starting to see that shift because of Putin's rhetoric as well as Beijing's expansion.
Yeah, now we're at that time of the show where we have to take a quick break. We're talking to Phil Hennigan from the New York Times, and we'll be right back.
This episode of NucleCast is brought to you by the AMLA Deterrent Center, whose mission is to educate Americans about the nuclear enterprise and strategic deterrence.
And we're back, and before the break, we were talking about, you know, this interplay of writing about it and interest in it. And so if you were to give folks within the nuclear enterprise sort of a masterclass on, hey, if you want to have as much influence as those in the disarmament community, what would you say would be, you know, three things that they could do that would be sort of beneficial to sharing their perspective on nuclear issues?
Well, the first thing I would say is that they need to talk more. I mean, you know, I wrote my last story for Time Magazine was on PF4 at Lanl, and it took me a year and a half.
Wow.
To get there. And when it did happen, you know, there were other journalists along with me, because, you know, I understood that they had to shut down the production line, and, you know, that made sense. But like, you know, it just takes so long. And I cover the military, so I know, you know, I'm very sensitive to, you know, I understand the sensitivities around these issues. But I feel like the whole nuclear enterprise is overly guarded. Oftentimes there's just good stories to tell and they're just not interested because of there's just precedent of just not engaging. So that would be the first thing. The second thing I would say is, you know, be more willing, you know, have some outreach to journalists, meaning, you know, the work that you're doing is you want it to be seen, you want it to be read, and you don't want it just to be read by the people that agree with you, I would assume. You want it to be read by people who don't agree with you or are on the fence on these issues. And so, you know, I feel like, you know, having a distribution list of journalists and spreading that information to them when you do publish these things, I think that that's a worthwhile endeavor. And also, you know, when you do find a journalist that you or you have a mainstream journalist that you the work you that you admire, reach out to them and let them know, you know, hey, I know you take these matters seriously, and this is, you know, this is how this is working. Because sometimes with the language of the nuclearati, you know, this sort of kind of speaking to each other in these terms, and it's very dense to get through, and it needs layman's terms to lay that out for people. And the third issue, a third thing I would think, you know, I think not to be overly critical when it comes to the coverage of nuclear issues, because this is a very hard thing to understand, you know, and that's why many of us are interested in it, is because it is so challenging and engaging to engage with the subject matter. And so, you know, if somebody gets a detail wrong or something like that, I mean, sure, bring it to their attention, but don't, you know, don't overly harp on it, because I think, you know.
So are you suggesting the calls for crucify him that we need to stop that?
I think so, because because it'll scare somebody off from ever wanting to engage with you again. I think, you know, I mean, that's just human nature. And to me, there needs to be a little bit of patience in this realm. You know, I have scars up and down my back having covered this, but you know, just a little bit of grace would be good.
Yeah, that's understandable, especially, you know, it's when you're taking the journalists who, you know, maybe have a interest but haven't spent a career, you know, working it, and they're trying to make sense of everything. And then you have, you know, like you said earlier, you know, you have the sort of the practitioners who do it for a living, and they're sitting there thinking to themselves, can I say it? Is it classified? You know, how, cause I mean, I have to think pretty carefully most of the time when I'm thinking, is this classified? And then you have folks who have never worked in the enterprise and have never held clearances, therefore they can say whatever they want, and they can raise their hand, and they can host events and do all kinds of things that, you know, that the other side is sort of skeptical of doing. Now let me ask you one question that I know, because I remember when, you know, when I was an Air Force guy, I would oftentimes, because I was a professor at Air University, I would get called in to handle press related issues, because I had a sense of freedom that, because of my, you know, job as a professor, that other elements of the Air Force didn't have. And there was always this concern that if you say too much, a journalist is going to misquote you, mischaracterize it. If you say something off the record, they're going to burn you, things of that nature. And I can tell you, general officers and others were always fearful of something like that. Can you talk a little bit about, is, you know, that type of a concern? Because it's an ever-present concern. So talk a little bit about it, and the legitimacy, or why you would do it, why you wouldn't, so that listeners can say, okay, I understand where he's coming from. And, you know, this is probably the most likely outcome, as opposed to my greatest fear.
Yeah. So I've only covered national security issues, you know, at the Los Angeles Times, at Time Magazine, and now here at the New York Times. So I got to be in the same room with you again, you know, and it's important for me. So as somebody who covers military issues and covers national security, it's important to me that the people that I talk to trust me. I mean, it's everything. I mean, that's all human nature to me is trust, various degrees of trust, right? And as a reporter, it's just so, and I always want to be open with the people that I cover. Like, hey, this is what I'm thinking about. You know, does this make sense? Of course, these relationships are developed over time, but you know, I think it's like dating or something. You know, you'll have a little bit of degree of trust with a journalist or a source when you first meet them. And then over time you develop, you know, more meaningful relationship in which, you know, one side trusts the other. I think that, you know, it's a shame that there's, you know, this, so, you know, feeling like somebody's going to just take what you say and turn it into something else. That's the opposite of what a journalist's job is, and I feel like they're, you know, the McChrystal, General Stanley McChrystal, and what happened with him. I do feel like that chilling effect is with us to this day, you know, up and down the military chain. But again, I just feel like you have to work at a relationship. It's not just going to happen right away. It's something that needs to be worked toward.
Yeah. So if you were to think through all of these articles and what you've still want to accomplish, what you've done, what you would like to accomplish, because perhaps some of our listeners will, you know, hear the podcast and say, hey, you know, I know a lot about that. I'll reach out to Bill and, you know, maybe offer some help. So what are you thinking about in terms of future articles? What are the topics you're trying to, you know, get better at over the coming weeks and months?
Well, I think to me, the Korean Peninsula is something that we want to really, really get into. And, you know, yeah, I absolutely encourage any of the listeners to reach out to me with their ideas on the North Korea or any other issues involving the enterprise. You know, we certainly want to talk about modernization and the efforts there, the various programs to modernize the triad, as well as the labs. And, you know, we want to talk more about what it means for China to have, you know, 1,000 warheads by decade's end and 1,500 by 2035, how that upsets the apple cart when it comes to stability. But, you know, those are the sort of the big topics of, you know, that we're looking at. But these are things that, you know, you would anticipate that we would, you know, there are other lines of reporting that I'm working on. But one thing I could tell you for sure is that any stories that we're doing will involve, you know, the sort of detail oriented and immersive experience that we tried to impart with readers on the first few stories.
Yeah. Now we're at that time in the show where I like to bring out my good friend, Bob the Genie. And as I rub my magic lamp, Bob, of course, grants 3 wishes to all of our guests. Now, you can't wish for fame or fortune or 3 more wishes, but if you were to make 3 wishes about the topics we've been discussing,
you know,
Bill, what would be wish number 1?
I knew Bob was going to make an appearance today. you know, it's funny because, you know, we kind of just discussed them, but I will say, you know, the first one is that I would love to have some sort of detente with North Korea, and I would love to be able to have a better understanding of what their arsenal looks like. You know, I mean, a lot of it is on display, you know, every month, but I feel like it's so, you know, this is the worst nightmare of the 90s, where we're at with North Korea, and their capability is just eye-watering. The advancement that they've made just in the last, what, 10, 15 years is impressive what they've been able to accomplish over this time. I'd love to know more about that, their arsenal, and I would love to be able to, that the U.S. government would have something meaningful come out of diplomatic engagement with them. So we do have those insights into their arsenal. But, you know, this is my wish for Bob. I am a realist. My second wish, in the same vein, I would say, you know, with China. You know, China's lack of willingness to engage with the United States on any sort of arms control talk, or even the slightest bit of disclosure when it comes to their nuclear policies and goals with what they're doing by expanding their arsenal. I would love to have you know, the U.S. government have insights into their arsenal, and so the United States would be able to better strategize about what that means for the future. And then my third wish, I think it's going to be on the U.S. nuclear modernization efforts. You know, I really hope that they, you know, that these various programs stay on time and budget and safe. You know, these things are done safely without anybody, without any sort of mishap happening. You know, I've covered weapon development programs over the years, and they're almost never, you know, on time and on budget. And it seems like, you know, there are some bright spots here, particularly with the B-21. But, you know, I hope that the United States taxpayer gets what they paid for when these programs come to fruition.
All right. Now, this is a, you know, a moment in which I ask the NucleCast audience, ladies and gentlemen, you've heard what Bill's had to say. You hear what he's interested in writing about and what he's looking into now. You now have an opportunity to reach out to Bill. His email's available. Reach out. Why don't you just tell everybody so that they can reach out to you?
Sure. It's just my first name, William, dot last name, Hennigan, Hennigan, at nytimes.com.
All right. So if you want to talk to him, you want to share your perspective and some of your expertise, Bill is there. And of course, go check out his articles. And Bill, thanks for joining us on this episode of NucleCast.
My pleasure, Adam.
And thanks to you, the listeners, as always. We wouldn't have a show if it weren't for you. So thanks for joining us again, and we'll see you next time. You know, hopefully, you know, it gave you an opportunity to hear sort of what journalists do, how they think, how they're sort of thinking about nuclear weapons and nuclear issues. And maybe, you know, it'll spur you to reach out to Bill or to you know, give insightful and, you know, feedback or information that can help them write better stories and be better informed. So I enjoyed the discussion, and I hope you did as well.
This has been a production of the ANWA Deterrence Center, a 501c3 that seeks to educate key decision makers, stakeholders, and the public to ensure a broader understanding of the nation's strategic nuclear deterrent. Our executive producer is Kimberly Charrington, and this episode has been engineered and mixed by David Frunkel. Help us grow our followers by sharing it and follow the show on LinkedIn, Facebook, and Twitter at NucleCast.